I get this question a lot. Hey, Mark, do you have a coaching certification program I can take to help others with relationships, but also something that will help me work on my own personal development? I love this type of question because it tells me that you're someone who's not just here to help others, but you're here to grow too. And to me, that's the key to being a great guide, is that you know the way within yourself too. You know the way through things because you've walked it. So if this sounds like you, a question you would ask, I've got something you're gonna love. My good friend Alyssa Nobrega, who's the founder and CEO of the Institute of Coaching Mastery, is hosting a free 5-day challenge called Self-Doubt to Sold Out from October 27th to 31st. And it's going to be incredible. You'll learn the exact tools to create deep, lasting transformation, not only in others, but within yourself. And if you're already a coach, a therapist, or a healer, you're going to discover how to grow a business doing what you love without burning out or losing the heart of your work. If you've been waiting for a sign to step into your purpose, this is it. Go check it out by heading to createthelove.com/challenge. Hello, and welcome to another episode of the Mark Groves Podcast. We have guests very rarely these days. I was moving to no more guests, but then I've been actually wanting to get today's guest on the podcast for a long time. So when I found out that this wonderful gentleman wrote a book, one that's right up our alley, Psychobabble, Viral Mental Health Myths and the Truths to Set You Free. Joe Nucci, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm really excited to sit down and spend some quality time with you, Mark.
Oh, me too. I mean, I feel like you're such a breath of fresh air in a field that I... And a conversation that tends to really avoid hard, like the hard subjects, speaking to the nuance of things, and also how we've really existed in a social media climate with a lot of buzzwords in the space of psychology and a lot of diagnoses via TikTok, et cetera.
Totally. Yeah. You know, it's, I totally get what you're saying. And it's kind of a weird thing to get present to because I feel like my field or even our field, like whether it's mental health or like self-help or however you want to categorize it, I think before social media, like it was like only nuance. You know what I mean? Right. It was like all context, all nuance, all getting very granular. And it's now like our emotional and relational lives have been flattened down to like 5 words, you know, like trauma, narcissism, love bombing, and like gaslighting. And it's, that's just not a good depiction of reality. And it's part of the spirit of what I do. Because I'm not a, I don't know. I once saw, what's his name? Tom Chi. He used to be at Google. He's like a technologist, like helped work on like the self-driving car, stuff like that. I once saw him on a panel and he said something like, I don't really want to be an important person. I just want to do like important work. And sometimes I think the people, I don't know what your thoughts on this are, but sometimes I think the people like in our fields, I don't know if they've clearly delineated that for themselves. Because for me, I try my very best to not, you know, not be a grifter, but not be like a sycophant either. Like, I'm not just going to say things just because they feel good. I want to tell you the truth because I think that honesty is curative in our relationships and in therapy or in a romantic relationship. So as best I can, well, anyways.
Isn't that supposed to be the role of therapy or coaching, that really there is a confrontation with reality, you know, because so much of our adaptive strategies are ways of actually not being with reality?
I believe that to be true. Like my answer is yes, but I would say that there are two important things. I would say that some people feel that there are things that you maybe necessarily cannot change. And so they call it in like the literature, it's like positive illusions. So there's like stories that you kind of like tell yourself to like make the hard times a little bit easier. And I think that can be adaptive to a certain extent. And there can be something therapeutic to that. I also think, you know, to not just a therapist credit, but particularly therapists with, you know, social media platforms, I know that sometimes I'll post something and I don't intend the message to be like, everyone else in your life is the problem and like you are not the problem. Like, I don't know if you saw this like video I did. It was like the accountability formula. It was about like how much grace and allowance to extend to someone, like a loved one with a mental illness. And the comments are just like thousands and thousands of comments, or it's just like, yes, I made the right decision cutting off this family member. Like, thank you for like validating me. And it's just like interesting because I'm like, that is not the point of the video. Like, actually, if you like go watch it. And so, but the engagement is so much stronger, you know? And so I think that just like an individual therapy, you know, if you want to go find a therapist to coddle you, you can go find one. You can keep switching them up until you find like your match. Now, is that what's best for you in your mental health? I would argue probably not, but it's not all on us is what I'm saying. I do think it takes two to tango.
Yeah, especially the lens through which someone watches content. Because I could, as you're saying, you know, put up a video about a specific thing and people could interpret it in two completely different ways in the way that they desire to with their own bias.
Right.
You know, and one of the myths that you bust is your feelings are credible. And I'm curious, is that one of the most prevalent ones in terms of the prioritization of feelings over everything?
Yeah. So the reason why therapists are always validating your feelings is that a lot of times mental health symptoms are correlated with emotional suppression. So for example, maybe someone has binge eating disorder or depression or anxiety or whatever it might be. I've looked at the literature. I've also just seen it in my practice. You work with them to feel their feelings, to express them authentically and congruently, and the symptomology goes away. It decreases. And that's really, really amazing. But I think what sometimes people forget is then they then take that to this extreme where it's kind of like, well, they then take that and say, oh, well, feeling your feelings is always good. And the only person, I think I write about this in the book, the only person that gets that deal is like a small child. Like no one, like if you actually take a step back for a second, it's like, what are you talking about? Your feelings are always good and like always express them or you're being mentally unhealthy. Like that's one way ticket to crazy town. Like maybe that's a reticle. I mean, to say, but like that's wild to me. In that chapter, I share a story and, you know, if I'm being honest, it didn't happen just one time, but the version of it I tell is, you know, I'm dating somebody new and all of a sudden their red receipts turn on. And they're not getting back to me, but they've read it. And this is different. Like, why are they doing that? And, you know, I have feelings about it. The one individual I'm thinking of, I'm no longer dating this person. And it's not because of this exact problem. But I, you know, I ask them about it later. I do not express my feelings. I don't believe them. I check in. I'm like, oh, hey, like, I noticed you've been leaving me on red. And they got the new iPhone and they didn't know that their red receipts were turned on. And it just wasn't like a thing. You know, like, thank goodness I didn't, you know, sit there in like kind of a self-righteous mental health literate way and was like, well, I'm going to express these feelings to you. And what I think a lot of people then do nowadays is they then extend that and say, well, if your version of reality conflicts with mine, right, that's like harming me because it hurts emotionally. And like, don't get me wrong, like that sucks when your perspective doesn't match up with somebody else's. But that's also like life. You know what I mean?
Right.
We can't do it all by ourselves. And so I think that's where like the myth comes from. And again, it's just missing that important nuance of sometimes to express is curative, but sometimes to suppress is curative. Sometimes adaptively avoiding the feeling is exactly what you need to do. I'll also add, you know, people come into therapy and broadly speaking, there's kind of one of two types. They come in and they don't really like cry or show any congruent emotion for like a year. Like they're just so disconnected from themselves. Maybe it was their upbringing. Maybe it was like, you know, a trauma or something like that. And so their work is like, no, feel your feelings. But then there's this other type where they come in and they're sobbing on the first day. They're having panic attacks in the middle of session. Like they really can't keep a lid on anything. And it doesn't take a shrink to tell you that the solution for that person is not necessarily to feel them more deeply. There could be other things that you need to do.
Well, and how important that is to be able to recognize that, our feelings, our experience, as you said, it's nice when they align with other people in a dating process. But if we can't hold that there's different worlds and different experiences, even in dating and relating, how do you hold it in this sort of greater cultural context?
Totally. Well, so this is more like on a personal share. I've started seeing somebody new. We're madly in love. It's so not rational. But what I'm in this moment, like what I'm present to about it is it's reciprocal. Like we're both showing about the same level of interest. We both want to go at about like the same pace. me and this person, we keep joking. We're kind of like, you know, it's like, oh, we're not going to like say anything crazy yet. But then of course, like, you know, we're letting the process along. But what makes it beautiful and wonderful is that it's reciprocal. And so often in dating, people are, their timelines or their expectations are mismatched, and they may not even necessarily know that. And so then what's a normal feeling, it starts to be cast as like unhealthy or dysfunctional. It may or may not be. But then to your point, you like extend that to something even broader, like feelings in like a family system or in like a community or culture or like society. And it gets tricky. I think it's extra tricky nowadays just because we all live in all of our information ecosystems are so individualized. Social media is a beautiful thing, and there's lots of good about it. But one of the bad things about, you know, we used to have like what, like three broadcast networks we would listen to. And it was kind of like, okay, like those are like the three kind of twists on like what's happening. But now it's like, I mean, you can tell any story you want. And if I had your algorithm and listen to your podcast, I would probably believe something similar to you. Just very, very wild. Very, very tricky.
It's like, yeah. It is. Like you can be, I think a lot of the big cultural moments, like, for example, most recently, the Charlie Kirk thing is like two people can have completely different experiences of the exact same event and then have the completely different information sources and validations and contradictions and everything. And yet we exist in the same world.
Right. It's even, so I was talking to an associate about this, and we were both commenting on, it's not even just that there's different information ecosystems. It's also like the, like, it's like confirmation bias on steroids. Because if you want to see like video proof, like proof in quotes, that he was a horrible bigoted person, like you can find those videos very, very easily. And then if you want to go see videos of him like defending Black people and gay people and like women, and like he's, and he's just like, you can also find that. And it's so, so it's like, it's even like a step beyond, like we're living in like a post-truth world. It's like, we're living in a world where it's like, even like, you know, quote unquote evidence or footage isn't going to like change your mind, you know?
Right. Right. Even if it's pretty, contradictory.
Which is pretty wild.
It reminds me, like, if you're dating someone and then there's a picture or a photo of them cheating on you and you don't take in the information because you have, what I mean? Like you have a specific bias about either they're really good or you couldn't imagine them. Like, must be AI. Now at least people will probably blame AI.
Oh my God. Yeah. Can you imagine? Maybe.
They probably will try, you know, they'll play like Shaggy's song. It wasn't me.
Yeah. It's, well, listen, I mean, denial is also a super powerful thing. I remember, one of my early lessons as a psychotherapist, you read about it in school. You read, don't rush to restore. That's what young practitioners do. They rush in to like give the answer and to, you know, try to help them along. And I remember one of my first patients, they came in, described their problems. And the next session, I basically scanned like a page of a book that basically described them and their problem to a T and highlighted it. We read it together and they were like, wow, that makes so much sense. And the next session, the third session, they came in, they didn't remember. Hmm. Like, they just didn't remember. They didn't remember the highlight. And I was like, I thought like, are you like fucking with me? Like, it was so like strange, but it was, I think it was too deep, too fast. It was too much, you know? And so we eventually did get there, but it was months later. And so that's, I mean, that makes me think of like so many different things, but I think that one thing that comes top of mind is it's like, different timelines, different cognitive processing speeds, different emotional processing speeds. You know, when you're mismatched with people, it can be really difficult, you know, particularly in relationship and dating. People aren't always on the same page. And I think everyone understands this intuitively because, I mean, is anyone listening like on the same page in terms of like their processing style or speed as with their like family? Like,
right.
Probably not. And those are literally your genetics. So it's kind of like, what are you like? You know?
Well, you know, because I'd say probably what in the last 6-7 years, but mainly I'd say during COVID, there was such a massive change online to a lot more psychological conversation, a lot more mental health conversation. And I'm curious, you know, given that you wrote this book, I am curious of two things. One, do you think we're better off because of it? Like, so what have been the maybe the improvements that have happened from more psychological awareness? And then let's get into like, how has this caused actually a lot of detrimental impacts?
Yeah. Well, you know, I would kind of play a reverse Uno card and like ask you and anybody who's listening and watching, we've never invested in mental health more. We've never branded it more aggressively or scaled it in terms of kind of awareness and culture. Do you feel like we're just drowning in mental wellness? Like everyone is just so conscious and so self-aware and such a, you know, so resilient and, you know, such an expert communicator. Like it doesn't feel that way to me. And I don't think that the data certainly doesn't indicate, you know, that we're getting better. I think we're a little bit better. The last time I looked at numbers, we're a little bit better today than we were like at the peak of COVID, you know, or
Which, like, that's kind of our rock bottom maybe.
Yeah, totally. But we're still not, we're still not like back, and we weren't that great before COVID either, in all fairness. I think that one of the things that I talk about in the book, and one thing I'm trying to really normalize in my content, is there's such a big problem, or there's such a big difference, excuse me. There's such a difference between a mental illness or a mental health concern and what we might term like a problem of living. You know, there's this amazing book that I read in grad school that really impacted me and impacts a lot of my work. It's called Saving Normal. His name is Dr. Alan Francis. He's written large chunks of the DSM. He's a psychiatrist. And he publishes this book in like 2013 or something like that. And basically the thesis of the book is don't medicalize everyday life, because not only is that morally or philosophically problematic, but we actually have literature and proof to suggest that it will make things worse for people. And so one of the things he says, and this is a paraphrase, but the quote is something like, you know, if it's a mental disorder, like it will not get better with time. It will not get better with social support. Like it needs clinical attention, or it's going to get worse. And the longer you go without clinical attention, the tougher therapy is going to be on the person. And that makes sense, right? Like if you get someone, they have a mild substance use disorder, very different from like a severe, severe addiction that has lasted decades and decades. Like obviously, you know, compare that to a problem of living. Most of those problems will go away with time and with regular social support, or just kind of figuring life out. And I think that this is particularly true. So one of my theories about all this psychobabble, what do you think about this, is like, I've noticed it really comes up in the following domains. It's like in the domains of like identity, of work, of family, and of love and relationship and dating. And I think that these are all areas in which we want to have more control than we have. Like the truth is, like, dating's hard. Like even like, you know, famous people, celebrities, people that are, you know, beautiful, right? Instagram influencers, like everyone's dealing with similar problems, like getting ghosted, liking someone that doesn't like you back. And like, why don't they like you back? Like you're perfect for them, right? Or like all this stuff. And I don't know, sometimes I think the psychobabble just kind of gives you a greater sense of control. But I think that really the best thing that you can do, you know, if someone doesn't like you back, is maybe maybe they're avoidantly attached, or maybe attachment styles only occur when you are actually attached to someone, you know, and maybe they're actually avoiding furthering intimacy with you, which sucks when you really like them. And again, if it's not like reciprocal, like that's like a painful place to be. But I don't know, so many people are maybe using a framework like attachment styles to try to like understand early stage dating. And I don't think it's an appropriate framework for it. And I think you would be much better served to, you can feel sad, like you can feel disappointed, you know, you put yourself out there and they didn't reciprocate, but that's a very human thing you did, putting yourself out there and being like, hey, I like you. Like, do you like me? And it's like, no. Like, oh, well, bummer, you know, but instead it's like, it's so much like intellectualizing and avoiding, and ironically, like not feeling your feelings in an adaptive way, I would argue. And I don't think that that's, I don't think that's what we had in mind when we like branded and scaled mental health like this, just like we as a mental health culture, you know, I don't think that's what we had in mind at all.
You know, one of the things I've realized is that our house, our home, is so much more than just walls and furniture. They're a reflection of how safe, comfortable, and connected we feel. And for me, the rituals I create at home, the moments where I'm winding down at the end of the day, are what make me feel grounded. And that's why I love Cozy Earth. Their bamboo sheets actually regulate temperature, so you sleep cooler and wake up more refreshed. And their bubble cuddle blanket, it's like wrapping yourself in a hug. It's soft, it's luxurious, and it's instantly calming. These aren't just products, they're experiences that make your space feel like a sanctuary. And you know, whenever I go away and don't get to stay in Cozy Earth sheets, I am excited to crawl into my bed. That's how amazing they are. I cannot emphasize that enough. And here's the best part. Cozy Earth backs it all with a 100-night sleep trial and a 10-year warranty. So it's risk-free. You could truly see how it transforms your nights. So if you're ready to elevate your home life, head to CozyEarth.com and use my code MARK to get up to 20% off. Because home isn't just where you live, it's how you feel. Let's go home with Cozy Earth.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think it's obviously beneficial to learn frameworks that you can apply to your behavior that allow you to change your behavior. You know, like I think the challenge is that you could take something like attachment style, then you could also talk about empaths and narcissists. Then you could move into codependency, and you could, you know, so there's like all these different, you could then go into nervous system and somatics and regulation and co-regulation and self-regulation. Right. So you could use all these different frameworks that basically like take a cluster of behaviors and then put a little label on them. But the problem, as you're saying, you know, if you say I am a certain attachment style, then now are your behaviors excused? And do you get to just blame the other person? Because what I see a lot online, which I've spoken a lot about, is like the majority of the people consuming relational information are people who are trying to figure out, like you said, this dating, trying to control, right? So if I like know enough, I think the interesting thing is that tends to be the type of person that goes into therapeutic practices or into coaching is there are people who want to resolve something within themselves or like figure something out. Mm-hmm. And so you have all these people who are trying to figure out why is this person that way and why did I get hurt? And then how do I change them so that they're not avoidant anymore? And also, which I want to hear your thoughts on, is we label any form of avoidant behavior like distancing, et cetera, ghosting, whatever it is, even disagreeing. We label it all, we often do, I don't want to say all, we often label it as narcissism. So like any behavior that is is like fearful of some form of intimacy, which could be because you get a little too hot, a little too fast, like you're over pursuing, you're someone who maybe has a more frenetic energy, you know, that you tell someone you love them in the first 3 days or first day, and then you're like, they're a narcissist. They ghosted me. It's like, what about your own shit?
Right. Well, I also think, you know, in terms of that, what I talk to patients about, what's really helped me is, you know, in English, we use this word love, but broadly speaking, it means more than one thing. On one hand, it is a feeling, but on the other hand, it's like a commitment and an action and a practice. And you can know, I mean, like within seconds, I would argue, like that spark, like that feeling and that passion, right? Even that deep, like caring, like empathetic feeling, like version of love, but you really can't know if you're experiencing or receiving the latter without time, you know? And I think that it's, you know, maybe we need two different words for it. I don't know. But I think that for me, just understanding that people, that it's not just a word that means two different things, but that people may not actually understand, you know, which they're speaking from. I don't know if it's true. So I don't want to be guilty of, you know, spreading psychobabble and misinformation, but I saw on NPR or something, they did like a study about, you know, prefrontal cortex activation when you're in love or like in like in infatuated with somebody, and it shuts off. Like it doesn't get as much activation, the logical decision
makes sense.
Parts of the brain.
It's like,
it makes
see
sense
you later.
To me because, you know, the most self-aware like therapist or coach or just person, you know, will just catch somebody's scent or glance and they're just, it's like out the window, like all the rationality, you know? And I would argue that maybe that's a good thing. Like maybe if we actually had that much self-control, like would we actually take chances? I mean, vulnerability is powerful because it's a risk, right? It's like, yeah, like vulnerability is strength. And like, I love what Brené Brown has done to kind of rebrand that word and awareness around it. But everyone always forgets to include what Brené also says in her TED Talks, which she talks about, you just need one person to know your story. Like, she doesn't actually say, like, you know, like, get on the internet and, like, show your wounds to the world. Like, you know what I mean? Like, she actually has technically not said that. Like, that's not, like, how she defines leadership. And I think it can be, of course, but, like, you know, it's, the point is there's real risk in it, right? And I, to your point about the narcissism thing, like, I don't know, my theory on why everyone's ex is a narcissist, because it's hysterical, Mark. When I was writing this book and people would be like, oh, what are some of the myths you talk about? I'd be like, oh, well, myth number 17 is called, you know, your ex is definitely a narcissist. Every single time it was the same conversation, it would go, oh my gosh, that word is so overused. I'd be like, I know. And then they would go, but my ex? And I would go, no, but my ex? You know, and it's like, it's part of the absurdity, because it's like, even if like, it is one in six people, which I think is a false number, by the way. I think that is
that
a social
feels
media
way
myth.
Too high.
There's no, there's absolutely no way. That's just been
not a
around
true by, like, narcissist. Yeah.
No. But the point is that like we
although
can't
it's probably
all
higher than
them.
It was. Yeah, we couldn't. Yeah, yeah, like we our Tinder is infected with narcissists, but everyone else's gets
totally. Yeah, bit. And so why? Here are that's a few funny. Of the things I write about in the book. Well, one of them is this idea of like you have insecure coping versus grandiose coping. And so insecure coping is the thought of like, oh, during a breakup, I'm the worst. Like I'm unlovable. Like I'm not good enough. I messed it up. Like I'm never going to be with anyone again. You're kind of one downing yourself. But then the other side of the coin is some people in that sort of stress, and breakups are super stressful, they one up themselves. And it's a little bit more like, don't they know how fucking lucky they were? Like, right. Like I don't fucking need them, you know? And it's still from a place of like wounded, like defensiveness. Mm-hmm. I'm not about to sit here and say as a mental health professional, well, one downing yourself is way better for your mental health. Like there is no proof of that at all. And I'm not going to sit here and say that, you know, it is necessarily inherently abusive or toxic to say mean things in the midst of a breakup. And now, of course, that doesn't mean like you should just, anyone listening, that you can like let it rip or you like deserved the mean things that were said to you. But in a breakup, you know, it's psychodynamic, a psychoanalyst would call it like splitting. You start to view things or people in all good or all bad terms. It's a feature of certain personality disorders. But I think in a breakup, it's super adaptive to have a period where it's like you don't mm-hmm. like the person anymore because it forces a separation.
I think that's important.
Totally. Well, have you seen, like, you might maybe see this more in your space, but sometimes I watch people that they like consciously uncouple and then they talk for the next 3 years and they hook up sometimes. And then there's like, there's drama. Yeah, and then all of their friends are like, I'm like, wait, is that like, are we going to say this is like healthier because you didn't have conflict in the beginning? Like, no, you sprinkled it over time or put it off for like a couple of years, right?
You never really ended either. You know, you like totally. Kept it and then you avoid entering relationship with anyone new. You never actually experienced the severance. I mean, there's so much.
Right.
You might even become polyamorous in that circumstance.
Yeah,
and
totally.
You become, what is the new term? Conscious monogamy or no, radical monogamy. That was the
is it radical?
Yeah. Yeah.
I guess these days.
It's not monogamy technically, but... That's how it was rebranded by some influencers.
Anyways, I think that that's at least one reason why we feel like all of our exes are narcissistic, because the grandiose coping and, you know, to go from like, let's say you and I, Mark, let's say you and I are in love and we're dating. I mean, you are, Mark, you're my sun and my stars. You know what I mean? It's like, I'm going to be deferring to you. I'm going to be like, all of your little quirks are so cute and like your perfect imperfections. And like, you know, it's like every love song you've ever heard.
Yeah.
But now we don't like each other anymore. And we're breaking up and I am no longer deferring to you emotionally anymore. Because guess what? We're breaking up.
Right.
or this is dead on the vine and we haven't accepted it or whatever it is. And so of course the contrast is I'm going to feel so much more selfish than what you were used to. That doesn't make me a narcissist, you know,
because I feel cold, right? Like if all of a sudden you're cold, well, of course you're cold. We're not in a relationship anymore.
Yeah, no, totally. We went from like, you know, like kissing, like, oh, my perfect baby boy, or like, you know, like whatever, however it is, like you talk like to one another, right? And then it's kind of like, oh, like now what? Now you're like not showing any sort of affection. Like that's going to feel super cold, and insensitive. I know I've counseled people and I know people in my life who they put off breaking up with someone because they can't stand hurting them mm-hmm. and they know how badly, but they're really just hurting them worse. in the long term,
right?
If it actually is a relationship that needs to end, it's actually like not kind because you're stealing time from them. And so anyways, yeah, those are some of my theories about narcissism. I also just really want to normalize this idea of like, if we're going to talk about narcissism this much, can we at least talk about it? Like it is a normative trait. Like so many psychologists believe that it's like, actually it's okay to have some healthy doses of it, you know, just like it's okay to be sensitive or extroverted, you know, or open-minded or agreeable or like whatever personality trait you want to pick. In extreme rigid manifestations, you know, being, let's say, highly agreeable, that could look like something like people pleasing and like kind of pathological, like, you know, like low levels of self-esteem or something like that's not good. Just like really high levels of narcissism are not good. But, you know, I think
it's still
some
an
people,
obsession with the self.
Oh yeah. Isn't it interesting how they're similar, the people pleasers and the narcissists? Yeah. Well, I love that meme. Like, oh, you're a people pleaser. Name three people who are pleased with you.
That's so good.
Like you probably can't.
So what other ones did you find were like when you were testing? Because I was watching your journey of preparing some of the myths and checking with your audience. So yeah. I'm curious, what were some of the other myths that you really saw people getting amplified by? I've noticed one I want to touch on if you don't bring it up, because it's a real hot button subject for me too.
Wait, which one? Let's talk about it.
The one on everything is ADHD and neurodivergence. Like
oh my God.
That one, first off, of course you can't pay attention. You have fucking TikTok brain. Like attention span. And then we put in this diagnosis. I mean, don't even get me started that you take kids and you sit them in a fucking seat all day in a school and expect them to pay attention when, you know, and then I think about drugs that are used to treat this thing that are basically meth. Like I just, I can't, I used to be a pharmaceutical rep for 14 years, so I can karmically understand that I have to undo a lot of what I did. But I look at it and I go, like, there's just so many issues that we just code as this diagnosis that then I forget what percentage of kids in the US are actually on. It's something like a quarter, isn't it? 20%. But that's crazy.
I mean, what I don't understand about it, Mark, is it wasn't even 5-10 years ago. I remember seeing like documentaries on like HBO or something about like the overdiagnosis of ADHD and like the pharmaceutical industrial complex and like, you know, this and that and like whatever. And then it's like, then like 5-10 years later, it's like, oh, everyone's kid has it. Everyone's grandma has had it all their lives. It wasn't diagnosed. And it's just this like weird shift where I'm kind of like, wait, like what happened? And I mean, I get into
it. It also became so political.
Yeah. Well, you know why? Because neurodivergency is actually a political term. It's not a clinical term. And people
don't even know this.
Well, people hate it when I bring this up, but it's like, this is not a secret. Like you literally go to and read the book Neurodiversity, the book of The Birth of an Idea by Judy Singer, who's not a clinician. She's a sociologist. And she says very plainly, this is a socio-political movement, you know, to unite neurological minorities. But then she does, and I can't quite figure this out about her thinking.
That's really interesting.
She then talks about how everyone is a neurological minority, but that is incorrect based on the term minority. Like it's this very interesting like phrase. I also, I read the whole book cover to cover, and I've read other kind of like thinkers and writers that have been influenced by the movement or a part of the movement. I can't quite understand what they mean like by systemic change. Like maybe like, is it just like a socialism communism thing? Like, is it, cause if it's, listen, if it's accommodations and policies, or like, you know, like institutional, like it can be like massage or institutions in a way to like make room for more people. Like I'm super like into that for sure. You know what I mean? But it's just like, it's not defined, which I find very frustrating.
Well, it can be, because if it gets defined, then now, you know, if it gets defined, then we have a legitimate thing we could talk about. But by keeping it this fluid, sort of mysterious, then everything can be it. And that's, I mean, I was on this one a little while ago and I said, who here believes they think differently than other people? And it was like 90% of the responders said yes. And I said, so by definition, you would be divergent. And so it's like this obsession with specialness, this like obsession with being different. You know, I'm curious your thoughts on this. This might be a controversial take, but I think that in a world where you have, if you have more intersections, you also have more protections from being attacked, that if you can pick an intersection like neurodivergence, it kind of takes you out of the target. Does that make sense?
Give us your thoughts on that. Well, I think that one of the reasons why it's been like popularized in a way, because I'll make posts about how, you know, like the point of therapy, the point of mental health, the point of self-help, the point of all of this is to transform. It's to be better. I have ADHD. Before I decided to disclose that on my platforms and channels, I remember the team of editors I was working with at the time, they were like, oh, we had no idea. And it was like, yeah, because I am correctly dosed to my medication. I practice executive functioning. Like, I take care of it. Now, it still holds me back sometimes, you know, like if I can't do all of the lifestyle things or like whatever it is, because it's like you just can't, like you just can't sleep and eat perfectly all the time. Like you can't necessarily prioritize it. Like that's life. And so sometimes, you know, it gets in the way, but overall it's very, very well managed. Now, in all fairness, maybe my case of it is more mild than other people. There is kind of like, you know, a spectrum of how severe it can be. But people get so mad when I say this, and they always bring up ADHD and autism as examples. Well, it's like, well, what about, you know, these two things? And it's interesting because it's never the bipolar people, which also doesn't have like a quote unquote cure. You know what I mean? Right. It's never right. like any of these other diagnoses. And I think that one of the reasons why is because, I mean, if I'm being quite honest, I think it's because if you haven't really like been in integrity with yourself and like really tried, you know, to make yourself better. And for those listening and watching, when I say better, I don't mean that it's like now you're no longer neurodivergent and you act just like a quote unquote neurotypical person. That's not what I'm saying. I'm saying, but are you able to be like more functional? Are you able to right. contribute and show up as a team member of your job and in your relationship and like with your loved ones, you know? And I have a hard time accepting for really anybody for them to be like, oh, well, this is just who I am. And I'll tell you why. I don't know if I've actually shared this one before, but, you know, people know me as such a great like speaker and writer. And I remember when I was younger, I struggled with those subjects. I remember seeing this commercial for, it was called Phonics. Do you remember Phonics?
Hooked on Phonics.
Hooked on Phonics. And I remember it came in this big purple box and I remember begging my parents for it. And I was like, no, like I need this. And I did it. And then it became, you know, English and history and like reading intensive subjects became like the thing I was best at, you know? Cool. And so like how sad it would be for me to be a kid today. You know, they send me to the school testing psychologist and they're kind of like, oh yeah, like he's got this, you know, put him on medication. When really I just needed a chance to develop at my own pace and in my own way.
Right.
And so I think that, you know, and there's so many stories like that, you know, parents who fight for their kids. And, you know, in terms of like learning differences and stuff like that. And I think that it's, maybe that's one of the reasons why I believe so deeply just in the potential of human transformation, whether it's in like therapy or coaching or something else. And I really do like, you know, people will, I'll bring it up in like other domains. Like I'll be like, well, you know, you can go into remission for borderline personality disorder. And that's not like my opinion, like that there's literature reflecting this. And then people want to get like, they're so desperate to prove the story wrong. It's so interesting. Like if I make a post to
fight to keep their label, you mean?
Yeah. So if I say that borderline personality disorder is one of the most curable personality disorders, which it is, you know, I have comments swarming with people like picking apart the study's methodology and this and that. But then if I say something like, which is not true, but like if I say something like, well, this is lifelong and like, this is like, you know, if it's just cotton candy, if it's just fluff, it's like no one bats an eye. It's so interesting.
100%. You know, there's that quote that it's like, you can either fight for your limit. Like people will fight for their limitations rather than their liberations. And it's so interesting to think about that. That identity itself is so freeing. You know, the diagnosis is theoretically freeing, but it's also can become a prison in and of itself, as you're talking about. I'm curious, what do you see as the most common founding pathology of bipolar?
The common pathology? You mean like
what cause? You see as like causes it.
I'm not sure if we totally know. I'm very fond. There's some really exciting. What's that guy's name? He's working on like metabolic theories of like mental illness. So he thinks it's like a metabolism problem, which makes sense to me because it's like a dysregulation. Psychiatrist. Yeah, because it's like a dysregulation of like too much energy or not enough energy. And it kind of makes sense to me because like, if you eat a bunch of sugar or take a bunch of stimulants, like you are essentially in like a hypomanic state. You know, your mind is racing, you have lower impulse control, you're probably taking risks financially, sexually. There starts to be some like overlap there. And so I think that's a really interesting theory. My favorite definition of mental illness, though, and this applies to bipolar or anything else, mental health, what's the definition of mental health? Mental health is understanding how your nervous system works and taking care of yourself. And so if you have bipolar disorder or some version of it, maybe taking care of yourself looks like taking a mood stabilizer, or maybe it's just knowing that, and now as the weather changes, I'm going to feel a temptation to sleep less and to do more, but that I need to kind of, you know, practice my different skills and tools. And then in the winter, I need to force myself to get outside, like, et cetera. And like, kind of just like keeping yourself like more balanced, because this is how your nervous system works. Your nervous system doesn't have the same guardrails that other people do in terms of your highs and your lows. For me with ADHD, it's something that helps me just like with my ADHD, taking like really good care, like of my body nutritionally, you know, supplements have really helped me, et cetera, moving my body for sure. You know, and then just knowing that when I don't do that, like, what is that going to look like? Like, what do I need to look out for? How does ADHD show up in relationships? I think that's a fun one. You know, all of these people, it's funny. It's like the whole internet thinks they're ADHD and on the autism spectrum. And then the whole internet is like, stop love bombing each other. And it's like, well, are you love bombing or are you hyper-focusing and hyper-fixating? Which is something that people with ADHD and autism do. You know, particularly like on a new crush, like all those chemicals, right. All that dopamine. You know, of course you're going to be fixated. Anyone would. But if you already have problems with impulse control, right? Maybe you are going to blurt out like, and I love you, or like a little earlier, like whatever, you know?
like, but I must love you because I feel these feelings. Yeah.
Yeah, totally. You know?
Well, the chill is definitely in the air where I live. And the days are noticeably getting shorter. And this time of year, the to-do list feels like it gets a little longer. And sometimes the only real sanctuary we have, especially in the midst of winter, is the space we come home to. And that's why I love what Avocado Green Mattress is doing. They help you create a natural oasis at home. From their certified organic mattresses to their cozy pillows, soft bedding, and even sustainably crafted furniture, every piece is designed to give you comfort you can feel good about. Comfort that's better for you and the planet. For me, that's what it's all about. Slowing down, finding rest, and grounding myself in a space that feels aligned with my values. Avocado makes that possible with quality that lasts and sustainability you can trust. So if you're ready to dream of better, head to avocadogreenmattress.com today to create your natural oasis. Avocado, dream of better.
I think about how much diet impacts so many behavioral things and developmental, like you're talking about with sugar. You know, and there's the thought that the overlap of dementia is type 3 diabetes. So, you know, resistance and you're having these big highs, big sugar dumps, insulin, et cetera. Yeah. Because keto is supposed to be quite good for like kids who have issues when they're young, developmental issues. So, you know, for autism, for ADHD, and they end up being in more of a ketogenic state. So it's interesting to think about because it's such a reduction of inflammation, that type of diet.
My theory on a lot of it too is I think that those kind of alternative approaches are probably much more helpful when it's more like the mild to like moderate cases of a lot of these things. But I would argue that if it is a mild case, is it a diagnosable mental illness or is this like just more of like you have certain traits? You know what I mean? And so it's like, I think that that's where, again, we get into that, like, is this mental illness or like a problem of living? And if one of your problems of living is that your energy is all over the place, then like, yeah, like, I mean, I don't think there's a doctor out there who would disagree. It's like being experimenting with carb portion and timing could really help you if you are like, you know, non-verbally autistic. Like, I'm not sure. I think it might be like a different ideology.
I agree with that.
And so it's tricky. And that's, and you know, that's one of the problems with all this psychobabble. Like, people will accuse me of being insensitive by pointing out these nuances, but I say, no, you are actually being super insensitive to equate your quirkiness as like a tech engineer and your preference for like systemic thinking or whatever with a person that literally needs disability accommodations to make ends meet. Like, you are two completely different people. And yeah, maybe you share some similar traits, but that doesn't mean you get the same label. And I think that it's, I don't know, did you watch that, what's that show that came out like a month or two ago? Unknown Number. It was like the, so for those listening, this is a spoiler, but basically you find out that this poor girl that's getting like harassed via anonymous text message for like 2 years or something like that, it ends up being her mom. And I remember watching the internet. It's so fucked up. And I remember watching the whole internet freak out at this teenage girl, like this young child
who
says, but I still kind of want like, I still kind of want a relationship with her. You know, like it's my mom. And everyone's like, how could she? I'm like, what are you talking about? How could she? This is exactly how a survivor of trauma and emotional abuse would respond, even if it wasn't her mom, like even if it was like somebody else. And so it's one of those things where it's like, we love to pat ourselves on the back and say, oh yeah, like we're so mental health literate. Like, we're so accepting. We're so empathetic, until it's a severe mental illness, until it's like your friend wants to get back with their abusive husband. You know what I mean? All of a sudden we don't have the tolerance for it anymore. And listen, it's super complicated. Like, I don't know if the right answer is to then, like, you know, accept your friend's decision so she can then internalize the message that this is okay for me to get back with my abuser. Like, I don't think that that's like, I don't think that's right either. I think it's super, super tough and complex, which is why we need all of this nuance. But it's kind of like, yeah, people love to say they're neuroaffirming until, you know, it's someone with autism who can't, like, you know, get through the day without being really disruptive. And it's just like, well, how progressive are you really when it comes to mental health? And that's not me. If that sounds taunting, I don't mean it to be. It's me being playful and like inviting people actually who are listening. It's like, no, like, think about what that would mean to actually have that kind of open-mindedness, that kind of education, that kind of compassion for people, you know, that are really struggling. I think the world would be better if we were all more like that, for sure. But I'm not convinced that's actually where we are, right? Which is so interesting. I think it's kind of like,
I think there's a lot of virtue presentation, but not a, you know, in the research, looking at people who identify as virtuous victims and how it shows that they're more willing to lie to appear. And there's a crossover with the dark triad behaviorally.
Yes. I do know this study. It's,
I think that's interesting to me. It is, because I think, like, first, what you were saying about, well, it hurts my feelings that you're saying this, that you're not validating, whatever. But the internet seems to, and I think this really came up probably in like 2016-ish is where I really started to see it, is that if I have feelings about what you're doing, then I need to stop you from doing that instead of experiencing my feelings. And if you're not sensitive to my feelings, then your whatever trope I can use that's popular that will automatically cause you to experience shame and potentially shut down, or I'll just get an army of people against you to cancel you.
Yeah.
Like, so I'm curious your thoughts on this.
Yeah.
This is my thought, and you could be like, nah, but my thought is that we have been pivoting around the people with the lowest capacity for emotional dysregulation, and they've been the ones generally in charge of what conversations we've been allowed to have. And the types of conversations.
Yeah. I think that's for social media, you're saying, for like internet discourse.
Yeah.
I think that that feels true to me, because the lower your resilience, the higher your sensitivity to negative emotion, the more likely you are to engage with the content. The more engagement that piece of content has, the more other people are going to see it, the higher the likelihood that someone else who agrees or disagrees with you is going to argue with you about it in the comments, or relate to what you're saying or not relate to what you're saying. It's tough. So what comes up for me is one of the myths I talk about in the book is about like being an empath. And one of the things I write about that I like to talk about is, I say, name one quote unquote empath you know who goes to a party or a music festival and feels all of that positive emotion and just gets drunk on it. 99% of the time, your empath friend isn't like that. they only right. feel the negative emotion. Now, it could be from trauma, right? It could be from like a personality disorder or like a temperamental thing. But I think that that's, it's one of those things where it's like, you know, they wear it like it's a badge of honor. I know a few people who I believe to be genuinely like very deeply like empathic creatures, and they feel everybody's everything, and good stuff and bad stuff. And, but they sometimes talk about it like it's more of like a curse. You know what I mean? They're like, I'm exhausted. Right. I mean, any like fantasy or like sci-fi show where like the character can like, you know, pick up on others people, like they're often like, you know, it obviously it's usually very like trying on them, and for good
reason.
Where's
the line though, where it's like an adaptive strategy, you know what I mean? Like, oh, I think we have a predisposition certainly to maybe more openness and more closeness, but I would wonder, there's got to be a giant overlap with developmental, like even in utero experiences in the womb. You know what I mean? Yeah.
Well, I know for me as a therapist, empathy is very helpful to attune to the person that's in front
so
of you.
Important.
Of course, but if I was in my empathy all day, I would burn out like pretty immediately. I think
social media would cook you.
Totally. Yeah. 100%. And I think it cooks a lot of people. And then it's kind of like, so then totally, well, then, you know, that person that's like the most sensitive, you know, is it a trauma thing? Is it a personality disorder thing? Is it a political thing? Or it's like, are you just burnt out like from the scroll, you know? Because I think some people will feel numb. They'll feel dead on the inside, but some people feel raw, like they're a raw nerve. Like everything is raw to the touch that they see. And so I could totally see that happening. To go back to your question earlier, like, is modern discourse ruled by like, you know, whoever's the most sensitive? Like, yeah, I think there's something to that, like, you know, like victimhood culture and consciousness and all that. But I think that a way that me putting myself out there, like on my platforms, like writing this book, like whatever, not that it's always been easy, because nobody, you know, nobody likes to get trolled. Nobody likes to get hate, myself included, but the systematic exposure to it, and like the careful and like the intentional exposure to it, it's really made me just like care so much less about being like liked by everyone for everything. And I think that it's a super important skill for people to have.
It is.
In life, you know, it's, I mean,
your
it's funny, right?
Your clapbacks are great, like, though. I do. Thank you. I got to give you thank props you. On that. Your clapbacks are so good.
Thank you. Yeah. But you know, it's a very empowering feeling. It's very like freeing. Just because, you know, nobody likes everybody. And if they say they do, I think they're a liar. Maybe they're lying to themselves.
I totally agree. And even the idea that you can't handle someone disagreeing or disliking you is, it's going to make it so you repress truth and self-expression. And that's not going to be healthy in terms of your physiology either. I mean, there's lots of data to look at that type of behavior and, you know, from childhood trauma, et cetera, like ACE study, looking at autoimmune, et cetera, from that type of.
Right. Oh, totally. Yeah. Well, something I think about all the time in this weird, like influencer economy we live in is like I just saw it. Like, I don't even like want to like say his handle. Like there's basically it's some dude that is just recently like out of the closet, and his whole brand is like, and I'm not exaggerating at all, but like his videos are like, I like men, but I'm not gay. And it's like this rejection of like gay culture and gay stereotypes. And it's so like,
is he Christian?
No, I don't think so. I think it's more, it's like he's come out of the closet less than a year ago, and he's documenting his journey for all of us to see, like on social media. And like, I actually, he's like, I'm not about like having gay friends or like gay culture. Like I want a partner, but it's like, I'm not going to be like those guys. Oh, over there, even though like you are one of us by definition, like, you know what I mean? It's very interesting. And like, this is actually very like,
you
normal.
Want to date them, probably don't insult them.
No, totally. But the point is that this is so something like, you know, like a college or high school student coming out of the closet would say, like, you know, because they're trying to figure out like their identity, their gender expression, like there's all these dynamics going on. But my concern for people who put themselves out there on social media like this is it's like, you know, unless you have the resilience to do like an aggressive rebrand, I don't know. I don't think you're incentivized to like let yourself kind of like grow and like continue and like develop like on your journey and like change yourself. Like, mm-hmm. you know, I have seen accounts just in the similar theme of like, it's like these really like religious, like gay dudes that are like praying it away. And it's just kind of like, I mean, like all the evidence like points to like how damaging that's going to be and that it doesn't work. And it's like, you know, you have your little following and it's kind of like, especially if you can start making a living off of it. Like, I don't know. I just don't see how it's like good for them is my point. It's not even about like gayness per se. Like, I think you could say this with like, you know, any type of influencer, like the people who like, you know, their story becomes their mental health journey. Like it's something like, well, what are you going to do if you actually get properly like medicated and you go into remission? Like you're not exactly you're like incentivized. To, like, all right, you know?
I guess I'm kind of done. It's like when I saw someone's handle, if it was like survivor of narcissist, it's like, who are you when you're done that? Like at what point do you move forward? But that's why I think the identity with all these titles can be such a trap. Like you were saying, if you're getting paid to do it, then what is your likelihood that you're going to let it go? I do remember listening to a great podcast on Christopher Ryan's podcast. It was called Tangentically Speaking, and he interviewed a gay porn star who started to like women again. And he was talking about how his audience was so sort of in love with the idea of him just being a gay porn star that when he decided that, well, when he started to feel like he was attracted to women again and he brought that forward, it was amazing the backlash he got.
Yeah.
You know, in terms of his own identity, but how they had him in this narrow box. And yeah, so it's interesting just to think about what you were saying.
Yeah, totally. Well, this idea that, you know, this is maybe a problem reserved for like news anchors or people with big public presences. It'll be interesting to see if, you know, influencers of, even if they're like smaller scale, will have the freedom to go do, you know, or be someone or something else. I think they should be able to, you know, I just, as a therapist, as somebody that like believes in the fluidity of your self-concept over a lifespan, I think that's super, super important. And maybe it's just another example of how like maybe social media isn't the best thing ever for our mental health if it locks people in.
Yeah, I think so much of the correlation to increase in mental health can be kind of like directly plotted with the advent of social media. While our awareness has gone up, you know, I think about how just the physiological impact of looking at a phone all day and constant dopamine hits and just what that does for us. But then how does that affect us relationally? Like I was listening to Scott Galloway and Esther Perel speaking. I'm not sure if you saw that podcast, but essentially Esther was saying we're in a convenience culture, yet humans are everything but convenient. And so you can get everything like your food delivered from your favorite restaurant to the couch in the way you want it. And then you expect relationships to be the same.
Yeah. You expect them to be the same. You want some convenience in a relationship. You want some ease. But if it's too easy, people don't actually like that very much.
It's boring.
It's boring. It's not quite as fun. So it's kind of an interesting meditation of it. Because it's a fine line to walk. Like I remember like the Gottman research says that like, you know, you need 5 positive interactions to every negative interaction or the relationship will feel too negative. But I believe I remember learning somewhere along the way that it's something like, but if it becomes more than 15 positive interactions or something to every negative, then it doesn't feel real. Like people don't actually like it very much.
It's not grounded. It's like too Pollyanna. You know,
totally. Yeah. And so I think that's kind of interesting, you know, particularly like, you know, whether it's marriage or dating, really, no matter if you're in or out of a relationship, it's like, you think you want what you want, but like, you sure?
Yeah. Well, I wonder if our capacity has become so low for any form of emotional fluctuation that it actually is making us much worse at romantic relationships. Like I was actually thinking about this, don't have the data for it. And let's be honest, the divorce rate, it could get worse, but it's probably not going to get worse. It's already kind of at its, like, I would say bottom and it has shown signs of getting better. Mm-hmm. But I'm like, if you can't be bored, can you really be in love? Like if you can't just stand in line at a Starbucks and not look at your phone, can you actually be in a long-term relationship. And that's where I think this inability to pay attention to something, in order to make a relationship work, you have to be able to pay attention to the space between you and the other person.
Totally. Well, you also, there's this wonderful book. What's the writer? Shauna Nyquist. She writes this book called Cold Tangerines. And it, the subtitle is something like Celebrating the Extraordinary Magic of Everyday Life. And I think that even if you're in a position, you know, financially, culturally, where you can just have kind of like an endless, you know, menu of very stimulating, interesting events, at the end of the day, you still got to shower, still got to go to the gym, still got to brush your teeth, still got to get groceries. Like no one is, you know, safe from all of that. And, and I think that there's a lot of something she writes about in the book is that it's something worth practicing to just kind of become enthusiastic about those little things. And I know for me, you know, when I'm with someone I love, and maybe that's like a partner, or even just like my family or a close friend, like going to the grocery store, it's not that bad, you know?
No.
Like, but it's in the connection that makes it good.
Well, I'm curious, for the people listening, who would you say that this book is for? Like, I think everyone needs to read it so that they have the awareness of all the things, and we can, I'll speak for myself first, which is that I think everyone should read this because we can all fall prey to what you're talking about, especially because it is like a language that is being spoken constantly. And if we don't actually learn the nuance of it, we'll get called the thing, we'll become the thing. And I think you do an exception, like, the most exceptional job of walking through the nuance of these things while still holding deep truths and being willing to tell us the truth that will ultimately liberate us. So there's my testimonial pitch. Oh,
thank you. Yeah. I really appreciate that. The book is dedicated, it's written in memory of my dad, who passed away when I was 11. And I dedicate it to anyone who is grieving or dealing with other inescapable problems of living. So to your point, that is kind of everybody, you know, everybody grieves, everybody deals with these things. I think that the book, I think, is especially interesting to people who absorb a lot of therapy content or mental health related content. There's actually on joenucitherapy.com, if you buy the book and enter your order number, you can get a guide for parents and teenagers, 109 questions we came up with about the different kind of psychobabble terms and kind of make, connect you all, like have generative conversation. I think it's certainly interesting to undergraduate students or graduate students who are in psychology, whether it's research or like a clinical kind of specialty. But I think the great thing about the book, you know, is you don't have to read it cover to cover. You can kind of bounce around the chapters or listen to it on Spotify or any of the audiobook platforms about the terms that kind of intrigue you. I will say, to your point, that I've had some loved ones reach out to me personally since starting the book, and they're just like, damn, I did not know that I was misusing some of these. And so I think for me, I appreciate your acknowledgement and compliment because, you know, I've been just thinking about this for the last like 2 years. Like, you know, like I literally wrote a book about it. And so for me, sometimes I think I underestimate how ubiquitous it is, because I am pretty good, you know, at turning like the shrink brain off. Like if I'm at a party and someone uses the term gaslighting in like an exaggerating way, like it's funny, like, you know, I'm not gonna correct them, like, but whatever. But I do think that, you know, maybe I'm not quite as present to, like, you know, how often they're being misapplied. The last thing I'll say is that, you know, for those interested, like, the spirit of the book is not this, like, you know, and my content as well, it's not this finger wagging, like, that's not the correct definition of this term. It's more like, no, like, it's actually like a problem that people are misunderstanding this term. Like, they're making decisions about their work and their love lives and their relationships that are antithetical to like mental health and like being adaptive and like carefully thinking things through and making it all fit together. And so it's more, for me, it's more of a medication and less of a supplement. Like, I think it's an important thing that people know.
Oh, it's awesome, man. I'm so excited that we got to chat. And
yeah, me,
I
mean, too.
I feel like we could dive into all of the,
oh my God, I know,
most cultural subjects. Yeah, we definitely have to. I feel like we need to dedicate an episode to that. And
yeah, totally.
Really appreciate you, Joe. Thanks for coming on.
Of course.